Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. What do you get when you combine absolute, unrestrained, laissez-faire capitalism where profit is put above people? What do you get? Particularly when it involves invading other nations in pursuit of that profit. Back in 1609, I realize this seems like a stretch. No, this is not a history lesson. Let me set this up. What this has to do, Tony Blair today announced, or yesterday announced, or is in the, you know, has over the last 24 hours announced, UK is on a different time than we are, announced that he is leaving office in a month or so. And his leaving office is, you know, it's like the big news, and it was at the top of the news on Air America News, and it's the big news in the UK. And the subtext to it that's most commonly being discussed is whether or not he really blew it in Iraq by joining the U.S. coalition. And his comment on the way out was, well, you know, maybe I did the right thing, maybe I did the wrong thing. I did what I thought was the right thing for my country. You're going to have to judge me. History will judge me, that kind of thing, which is, you know, what you would expect him to say. But Tony Blair did have a singular accomplishment, but not one. I mean, he had a number of accomplishments during his time as prime minister, some that I would applaud, others that I wouldn't. But the main one happened just a few days ago, and it really got very little coverage in this country. And there's an enormous lesson in this for us, because it has to do with what's going on right now with the melanin coming from China and contaminating our food supply. And the British potato famine and the terrorists who knocked down our towers on 9/11. Now, how do you pull all that stuff together? Well, here's the story. In 1609, the British were doing to Ireland what we were doing in the Middle East after World War I, saying, oh, you guys have a resource, we want it. And in 1609, they started the first British settler. It was called the Plantation of Ulster, where they confiscated native-owned land, because the resource then was land to grow food. Now we're talking about oil. And mainly Protestant, mainly Scottish, English and Scottish planters settled Ulster. And this led to a series of bloody wars, the War of 1641 to 1653 and the War of 1689 to 1691. And these were not just wars of the Irish wanting to repel the British who were taking their land, but they also then morphed into religious wars, because the Irish were almost universally Catholic and the British who were settling were almost universally Protestant. And so these became wars of religious radicals against each other, and they were radicalized by the influence of this doctrine of laissez-faire capitalism, which ruled Europe for the better part of the last 7,000 years in various forms, and certainly England for the last couple thousand years. It got so bad that in the first winter of the Irish potato famine, 1846-1847, that winter, as 400,000 Irish starved to death. And it takes a lot. I have worked in famine areas. I worked in Uganda in 1980 and 1981 during the famine that was the result of the war against Idi Amin. As Amin and his troops fled north, as the Tanzanians came in from the south to evict him, they fled north through the Karamoja region. I was working right up on the border, the southern border of the Karamoja region and the northern border of where the jungle ends and the desert begins, essentially, in central and northern Uganda. And his men, about 10,000 of them, they fled through that area. They murdered all of the men, all of the military-age men and young boys, and raped every woman in sight. and they killed the cattle. And the Karamojong, these people were, you know, traditionally were cattle herders. In fact, the main part of their diet was blood and milk. And they were starving to death. And we took over the Numalo prison farm and helped start a famine relief center, which then morphed into a hospital, which is now both a hospital and a place where AIDS orphans and AIDS widows are joined to create new families and that sort of thing. It's still going on. The Salem work based out of Germany this organization that I've done international relief work with for 28 years now. And so the point is I've seen famine, and I can tell you, and I've buried the bodies of children who died overnight. I mean, every morning I had to get up and go through and find the bodies of the people who died while we were still waiting for the food to arrive. And it takes a while to die from famine, and it's an awful thing to watch. And so as 400,000 people died of famine in the winter of 1846 in Ireland, I don't say this as a dirty word, the capitalists, because I consider myself I believe in capitalism, but I believe in capitalism restrained by government, capitalism that operates in a way that is useful and functional for society, rather than it's like cells divide, but when cells divide in an uncontrolled fashion, it's called cancer. And this unrestrained laissez-faire capitalist idea that the British had exported to Ireland, as 400,000 people starved, the British landlords who owned the land of Ireland exported 17 million pounds sterling worth of grain, wheat, oats, and barley, cattle, pigs, flour, eggs, poultry, enough food to feed 12 million people. As 400,000 people in Ireland starved, they exported from that country, and they would kill people for stealing food. In fact, there was just one. Paddy's Lament is a great book about this. Thomas Gallagher wrote it, and he talks about this one ship, just one ship, as a for example, the Ajax. It sailed from Cork to England in the winter of 1847, the depths of the famine, carrying 1,514 firkins of butter, 102 caskets of pork, 44 hogsheads of whiskey, 844 sacks of oat, 247 sacks of wheat, 106 bales of bacon, 13 casks of ham, 145 casks of beefsteak, 8 sacks of lard, 296 boxes of eggs, 30 head of cattle, 90 pigs, 220 lambs, 34 calves, and 69 miscellaneous packages, while the Irish were only allowed to eat potatoes. Well, the reason I mention this is because a couple of days ago, Ireland, in Northern Ireland, the Catholic and Protestant factions of Northern Ireland finally signed a peace accord, which resolved ultimately the troubles from 1968 to 1998 that started with a march back in 1968 by the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association. That turned ugly and turned violent and then led to 3 decades of terrorism against the British, blowing up bombs. I mean, you know, they almost killed Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister, blowing up a bomb near number 10 Downing Street. They're blowing up train stations, blowing up innocent civilians. Terrorism coming out of Northern Ireland is a result of these people feeling oppressed by what was literally 300, you know, going back to 1609, hundreds of years of oppression. And now, because the British did not say, oh, you guys are evil, you guys need to be bombed back to the Stone Age, because the British didn't say that. They said instead, okay, let's work this out. Let's sit down and talk. And it was a difficult and long process. I mean, 30 years of dealing with a terrorist threat, 30 years of Protestants being murdered by Catholics, 30 years of Catholics being murdered by Protestants, the 30 years of the Troubles, and more. I mean, you know, we're really looking at a 300-year history here, going back to 1609, the first settlements, were resolved as this historic event took place, where Ian Paisley and Bertie Ahern, a power-sharing government now in Northern Ireland.
From the depths of my heart, I can say to you today,
Ian Paisley,
that I believe Northern Ireland has come to a time of peace.
I mean, this is amazing. This is doing it right. Now, doing it right and doing it wrong, two different things. Let's contrast that with what we're doing in Iraq, and let's also contrast that with what may be coming down the road as the consequence of unrestrained capitalism now infiltrating China. Right after the break. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Back 21 minutes past the hour. I said Paisley and Ahern. It was Paisley and Mark McGuinness, actually, who said that the Reverend Eden Paisley, the leader of the Democratic Unionists, which is the dominant party of Northern Ireland's Protestants, and Martin McGuinness of the Republican and mainly Catholic Sinn Féin Party were sworn in as respectively as the leader and deputy leader of the new government, the new executive government of Northern Ireland. And this, you know, a big deal, a big deal. This was on May 9th, and which yesterday. And 3,700 people died during the 30 years of the Troubles. 3,700 people. Which kind of brings us to, you know, over 3,000 dead. Look at the number of Americans who have died in Iraq because we're pursuing a policy that's not all that different going into an oil-rich country and saying, you know, hey, resources. You do know, of course, that
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yes, as the Dark Prince would say. And so here we've moved in, and people in Iraq are saying, hey, you know, we're not all that enthusiastic about laissez-faire capitalism. We're not all that enthusiastic about the fact that you changed our constitution so that multinational corporations, Bechtel and Halliburton and all these companies, can come in and basically do whatever they want. We're not so enthusiastic that you're doing away with our social safety net, doing away with Social Security, privatizing our schools, doing away with free public education, doing away with free public health care, changing the tax code so that it's now a flat 15% tax on everyone rather than a progressive income tax that Iraq had before when Iraq was a relatively cosmopolitan nation, and bringing in religious fundamentalism. Now, at the same time, see, because our question here, the question that I wanted to set up for this hour is, how does laissez-faire, absolutely unregulated, raw, naked capitalism lead to harms from terrorism to kidney failure? Federal officials on Friday placed a hold on 20 million chickens raised for market in several states because their feed, this is in the United States, because their feed was mixed with pet food containing an industrial chemical. This is in the Associated Press. Investigators found last week that 5% of the feed used at some smaller chicken operations came from pet food tainted with the chemical melanin. Gee, where did that come from? At the same time, the International Herald Tribune reporting in China, out of the Boston Globe, the Herald Tribune reprinting it. In China, some farmers try to maximize the output of their small plots by flooding produce with unapproved pesticides, pumping livestock with antibiotics banned in other countries, and using human feces as fertilizers. Chicken pens are frequently suspended over ponds where seafood is raised, so the chicken waste is recycled as a food source for the seafood. Representative Rosa DeLauro, a Democrat of Connecticut, is fighting a change in USDA rules that would open up the U.S. market to cooked chicken. She says, China doesn't deserve entry into this closed poultry market here in the United States. U.S. agricultural exports from China. This is food, the stuff we eat from China. Ballooned from $1 billion the year after Bush took office to $2.3 billion last year. I mean, that's a bit of an explosion there. They over the ponds, they have the chicken cages. It might be like 20,000 chickens in cages. The chicken feces is what feeds the fish and the shrimp. The shrimp imported from China then contain antibiotics that no amount of cooking can neutralize, not to mention that about 10%, according to the USDA, has been found to contain salmonella of what little they actually inspect. Just last month, the FDA, which does very limited inspection of these billions of dollars of imported food, just last month, from China, the FDA rejected 51 shipments of catfish, eel, shrimp, and tilapia. That fish you find in the restaurants, isn't that cool? Ah, tilapia. It's from China, and it contains salmonella, veterinary drugs, and nitrofurin, a cancer-causing chemical. Now, it may be that the tilapia you're eating in your local seafood restaurant is not from China. You might want to ask, but it's like this is, hey, well, for example, here in Oregon, we have seven fish hatcheries that got some of their food from a company called ChemNutra. It's a Chinese company. Or it was imported from China by ChemNutra, based in Las Vegas, a Las Vegas company importing the raw materials from China. And it turns out it was contaminated with both melamine and cyanuric acid. Or cyanuric acid. It's a chemical used to treat swimming pools. And this is what causes kidney failure in pets. And now it's in our farm-raised fish here. And not just in Oregon. And this is happening all over. And not to mention the story we talked about last week about how in Panama, 260,000 bottles of cold medicine where they thought that they had added glycerin to it. Actually, they had added diethylene glycol, which is a poison. Hundreds of dead children in Panama. Why? Because of absolute unrestrained laissez-faire capitalism in China. No rules, no regulations, just make a profit. And people are being hurt 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270.
Speaking of family, join us tomorrow in San Diego at the KLSD AM 1360 Listener Party at the Cosmopolitan Restaurant in San Diego's Old Town, 4 to 8 p.m. Call 858-292-2000 for more information. And then, of course, on May 17th, I'll be in Denver, KKZN AM 760. We're going to be doing a live show from the Boulder Theater. That's at am760.net. And May 19th, I'll be in Santa Fe doing the show live from KTRC in Santa Fe, our affiliate there, and also a speech and book signing at the Greer Garson Theater at 1:30 on the afternoon of May 19th to get free tickets, listen to KTRC, and find out how. So a lot happening in the world, by the way. I just want to give you a quick snapshot of some of the things that we will be digging into a little deeper as we go on through the program today. The Gang of 11, the 11 Republicans, went and sat down with George Bush in the White House yesterday. And basically, one of them said, you know, your popularity rating is 5% in my district. I think the bottom line message of these guys is, we're not going down with you. And Bush seemed to, according to reports, not leaked by the White House, but apparently leaked by these Republican members of Congress, sobered. This is why I was making the point yesterday that the widespread corruption in the Republican Party needs to be identified and made clear, along with the members of the Republican Party who are not corrupt. I mean, my call is for people of goodwill to take back all of the parties. Right? Let's return competence and statecraft to this nation rather than incompetence. So number one, that's going on. The Gonzo Gate is continuing. Alberto Gonzalez testified before the House Judiciary Committee today, John Conyers Committee. It'll be interesting to see how that all shakes out. That's going on as we're speaking. Robert Gates has pledged that he is going to send troops home for at least a year between deployments. He has apparently broken that pledge. We see troops now being recycled for 15-month deployments with only 9 months at home. This is leading a lot of folks in the Army, military officials, to be concerned about the mental health consequences, both short-term and particularly long-term. And finally, a majority of Iraqi lawmakers have endorsed a bill calling for a timetable for withdrawal of foreign troops. This, very straightforward. WTNH reporting this. The bill would require the Iraqi government to seek approval from Parliament before it requests an extension of the UN mandate for foreign forces to be in Iraq. It also calls for a timetable for the troop withdrawal and a freeze on the size of foreign forces. So we'll see how that shakes out. But back to the main point that I wanted to make. And this was just an aha for me. I mean, I was literally, night before last, I think I was laying in bed watching BBC News as I was falling asleep. And they were doing this whole thing about the end of the Troubles. Now, the Troubles officially ended this 30-year period of conflict in Northern Ireland in 1998. But the total reassuring disarmament of both the Protestants and the Catholics didn't happen until the last couple of years, and the official end was early this week, late last week, arguably, depending on, when the thing was hammered out, when the thing was signed, when the ceremony was held, all that sort of thing. And Tony Blair now stepping down and trying to tie it, frankly, I think he's trying to tie the two together so that his legacy will be this, and that's a fine thing. And we have to acknowledge, A, Bill Clinton played a role in this. A number of U.S. presidents played a role in this. George Bush even played a role in this. He went over and gave it a good at you. I wouldn't say he played a significant role, but Bill Clinton worked very aggressively at this. And the British dealt with it as a police problem. They didn't go in with an air force and bomb Belfast. Now, Belfast was heavily militarized. I remember driving around Belfast with Louise and our kids in 1980, I think it was 1985, 1886, and we got into a neighborhood where we weren't supposed to be, and we had a half-track follow us out with a machine gun pointed at our rental car. But, we spent a fair amount of time in Dublin and talked with a number of people, and talked with a number of people and got some general sense, and one of the very best books I ever read about this, I'm not even sure, I think it's available in the United States, you could probably Google it, or find it on Amazon. It's called The Crack, and I it's been 20 years since I read it. I don't recall the author's name, but it was it's called, the subtitle is A Belfast Diary, and it's just amazing. So, here you see how an occupation and the damage caused by unrestrained capitalism combined with imperialism is ultimately healed in Ireland. Why don't we learn that lesson with regard to the Middle East? Why don't we learn that lesson with regard to those countries? And are we going to see that lesson repeated as China now becomes the next imperialist / unrestrained capitalist force that doesn't even have a pretense of democracy? Our trade deficit with the world, this just now today being reported by the New York Times, trade imbalance with the U.S. and the rest of the world, higher than ever, $63 billion for the month of March, a jump of 10%. This is more stuff we're buying from the world than we have here. And then at the same time in today's New York Times, an article about how physicians, doctors who give risperidol and other antipsychotic drugs to kids to kids who are not psychotic, are receiving payments from the drug manufacturers. From 2000 to 2005, drug maker payments to Minnesota psychiatrists rose more than sixfold to $1.6 million. During those years, prescriptions of antipsychotics for children in Minnesota's Medicaid program rose more than ninefold. See, we're seeing this all over the world. We're seeing this in all these different areas. And I think it's time for all of us all around the world, all of the various countries to say, hey, wait a minute, we have a problem here with these twin notions of empire and of absolute unregulated, unrestrained capitalism, and we need to back off a little bit and understand that people want to have national sovereignty, and people want to have control over their own natural resources and their own national resources, including us, by the way. And move forward in a way that accepts that, rather than simply saying, oh, if somebody fights back against our occupation of their country or against our supporting their corrupt government for a 40, 50, 60, 80-year period, they must be evil. They must be evil, because it's not just good and evil. Tomas in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Tomas.
Hi, Mr. Hartman. Thanks for the opportunity. You know, if the British, one of the British parties, had told Tony Blair that he only had 3 months, you know, they wouldn't be talking. They'd still be fighting there. The British stayed. They did not run, as the Democratic Party wants to do in Iraq. And
no, I don't. Tomas, you know, come on. There have been actually. You want timelines? Go back and look at the history of the Troubles. Go back and look at the history of all the different times that they sat down and said, okay, we're going to do a timeline. There were timelines over and over and over again agreed to by both sides. Everybody understood that there had to be benchmarks, there had to be milestones. I'm sorry, I'm not going to go there. Aoi in Eugene, Oregon. Am I pronouncing your name right?
Yes, thank you. First of all, I really think it's an interesting parallel that you're drawing between Ireland and Iraq. I wanted to, with all due respect, correct a couple of misstatements, if I may. I'm Irish, and the English oppression began 800 years ago, so it's actually taken 800 years.
I'm sorry, I missed what you said.
I mean, Cromwell and his bombing campaign, I mean, we never really left the Stone Age in the first place. But
sure.
Cromwell took care of what little civilization was there. And I also wanted to let you know that a lot of people don't understand this, but the English created the famine. They seeded the potato with the fungus that killed the crop. So,
you know, I've read that as an Irish conspiracy theory. You consider that an actual fact? That what would be the advantage to the British of killing off the Irish?
Because they wanted them out of there, and they have actually admitted it. It's been
oh, really?
Yeah. And they were the ones who suggested that the other half of my lineage, Native American, the blankets be seeded with disease because they had to
test. Sure, yeah. Well, that's well documented.
Right.
Yeah.
My point is that I think that the problem, because you asked when will we learn this lesson, and I think that the problem is that America, at 200 years old, but yet suddenly becoming the most powerful nation on earth, thinks it's older and wiser and smarter than
yeah.
it is, and it took England, 900 years?
Yeah, 1,000 years to figure this out. Yeah. Good point, Aoi. Good point. I'm sorry we're up against the clock, but you made your point very eloquently, and thanks for setting me straight on the numbers. 45 minutes past the hour.
In broadcasting, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Save us from the lies. Save our homes from foreclosing. Stop treating us as spies. Save our jobs from leaving. Bring back made in USA. Represent the ones who made you, not the ones who paved your way.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Hey, join me in Dubrovnik, Croatia for the conference, the Praxis Peace Conference, Transforming Culture from Empire to Global Community, June 3rd through the 9th. Grant Eisler, Tom Hayden, George Lakoff, David Corton, Francis Moore LePay, Hazel Henderson, Swami Vyandananda. Louise and I will be there for the entire week. And you can hang out with us in Dubrovnik. We'll be doing the radio program from there, electronics God's willing. It's all over at the website Praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, Peace, praxispeace.org for more information. 9.5 minutes before the hour, and Catherine in Long Beach, California. Hey, Catherine.
Good morning. I just have a few things to say, Tom. First off, the analogy is great. I was telling your screener that there was an Irish song, and did you ever go across the sea to Ireland? And in it, it says, the strangers came and tried to change things their way. And ends by, they might as well be swinging by a star. And you have to realize, and Americans have to realize, we've had a lot of propaganda. We had Northern Ireland Irish people that couldn't vote, couldn't hold land, and couldn't find a job because when it would show what school they went to, and if it was a Catholic school, they wouldn't get hired. They couldn't vote. Mm-hmm. And this was till the 70s, and this is what caused the troubles. And I want to just say another comment. The Irish are the second highest standard of living in the world right now. I heard this on PBS the other day. Mm-hmm. And they're the most giving per capita in the world. And it's because they went through the famine. They know how horrible life can be. So there is.
Well, and it's also, I would say, the main reason why Ireland's economy has gone from being rather anemic 30 years ago, the first time I went to Ireland, to being a boom, is that during that 30 years, they, about 20, 25 years ago, and somebody I'm sure will have the exact date, probably somebody who was living in Ireland at the time, decided to offer free college education to everyone. And so Ireland now has one of the most well-trained, workforces in the world.
Right.
And I mean, that was just a big deal. And you know, many other European countries have emulated that in various forms, but this was a major transformation for Ireland, and it's something that, frankly, we did in the United States with the GI Bill after World War II, and it was one of the things that helped build the great middle class of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And then, of course, the Republicans got a hold of it in the 1980s. Reagan, in the late 70s, ended the free University of California system and took apart the final pieces of it, I guess would be a better way of saying
it. Right. And the bottom line is they've always been known as the island of saints and scholars. They've always pushed education. It's been important to them.
Yes.
But the other thing is, Tom, my friend, she's from Iran, her husband's from Iraq. I need to say this. Before we went to war there and we were told to go out and get duct tape and plastic to protect ourselves, they said this is never going to work. As much as Saddam is not a good man, there's going to be a civil war, and the bottom line is he has always protected the Christians. Now, they're the original Christians. They still speak Aramaic. Mm-hmm. He would not let them deface
the Christians in Iraq.
This is in Iraq.
Yeah.
Saddam would, he only trusted Christians. He didn't trust the other Muslims.
He also, oddly enough, protected the Jews in Iraq, even though he was giving $25,000 to the suicide bomber families in Israel. He was protecting all the religious minorities because he did not want any religious majority or minority, for that matter, to gain power. He was a total secularist. He was very, very concerned about the power of religion.
Exactly. And if someone invaded our country, now, wouldn't we be doing the same thing? There'd be suicide bombings. We'd be fighting any way we could. And the bottom line is the Germans did it in the Second World War as well, putting teenagers, young boys out to fight at the last minute. So no one can sit back and say, if you're not invaded, that you're going to, if you're invaded, you're going to sit back and do nothing. You will.
No, if Canada decided that George Bush wasn't properly elected and decided to invade us, to liberate us, even though I would agree with the basic premise, I would be out there with my musket saying, no, Canadians, head back north to the border. Thank you very much for the call. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph.
Yeah, Tom, two quick things. First of all, remember that the first capitalists were the lords that enclosed the common. Many places,
yes,
many
good
times.
Point.
Scotland,
good point.
Ireland.
Sure.
And
starting largely in the 7th and 8th centuries as England was Christianized, and because, through the 5th and 6th and early 7th centuries, it was primarily a pagan country and was more tribal. And then it really picked up steam after the Norman invasion and in the Battle of Hastings in, 1066?
Exactly. And if you start equating the feudal lords, essentially, with modern capitalists. There you have it.
Yeah.
Second.
Well, that's the origin of modern capitalism.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's
the system. The idea of creating a limited liability corporation is not that different from the old feudal lord idea of having immunity from prosecution for a whole variety of crimes that could be committed simply because you had a title conferred by the crown.
Well, and you can take that back to the Romans also.
Sure.
The purpose of their empire was to acquire land and grain.
Yeah.
And the one thing, this is the second thing I wanted to point out, and that is the problem, if you do take it back to the Romans, that makes me very scared about our vice president's comment on oil, is that whenever the people didn't give up the commons, it would be, as Tacitus put it, they have made a desert and called it peace.
Yes,
you simply
Tacitus.
You eliminate anyone that opposes, and I'm afraid that's sort of where we're going.
Right, and Tacitus was the son-in-law, as I recall, of Agricola, who was the Roman general who invaded in 56 B.C., as I recall, the British Isles.
Right.
And Tacitus... Tacitus wrote the history of that. It was one of Thomas Jefferson's two favorite books, by the way, which is why I read it.
Well, and what I quoted is Tacitus, the words that Tacitus puts in the mouth of the, I guess you call it the British...
The tribal chief. Yeah, whose name I forget. It was one of those kind of tribal British names.
Why are people fighting to the death, ambushing Roman troops, killing anyone they can, acting as terrorists?
Yeah, no, it's
because
people...
you will take my land.
That's exactly right. And people should go back and read Tacitus, as Jefferson recommended. In fact, half a dozen different times in his diary, he said everybody should read Tacitus. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Former U.S. Attorney David Iglesias saying, I think all roads lead to Rome. This is from the Albuquerque Tribune. He says, I think that's why the president is circling some pretty major wagons around him to keep him from testifying under oath, which subjects him to criminal prosecution. I'm assuming the him that Iglesias is talking about is Rove, not Bush, but it'd be interesting to find out if it leads to both of them. We will keep you up to date on that and whether Mr. Cheney is asking for a timeline of the Iraqis. The Republicans, I think, certainly broadly, increasing number of Republicans would like to have this whole Iraq occupation mess behind them before the elections, but that's another issue. James Inhofe's office, the senator, the good senator from Oklahoma, is at it again. He's the now ranking member. Is it what Mark Morano? Is it called ranking member? Number two guy on the committee?
Guy in the committee, the minority chairman, if you will, but there's no such title, so it's ranking member.
Ranking member, right, of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. And you guys have issued here, let me just set this up a little bit. NASA, the Goddard Space Flight Center, just issued a press release, and this is not exactly a Democratic or Republican group, about what we can expect here. New study by NASA suggests that greenhouse gas warming may raise average summer temperatures, and I'm reading from their news release. This is not the Democrats' version of their, or Al Gore's version of their news release. This is the actual official NASA news release. Just came out today. A new study by NASA scientists suggests that greenhouse gas warming may raise average summer temperatures in the eastern United States nearly 10 degrees Fahrenheit by the 2080s. They say, but in July and August, daily temperatures could be between 100 and 110 degrees Fahrenheit in Chicago, Washington, and Atlanta. And this very, very small, let's do some little tiny thing about this, like CO2, carbon dioxide cap and trade programs, where we're going to try and use some function of the market to diminish the use of carbon. You guys have already come out and trashed it.
Well, I wouldn't use the word trash. We're opposing it. First of all, that NASA study you cite is, first of all, NASA is, of course, James Hansen's one of their most prominent scientists, and who's been there, I guess, since 1980, at least the late 1980s, started all this. And James Hansen is one of Al Gore's advisors. James Hansen has taken now over $500,000 from environmental special interest groups. I don't hear you complaining about NASA's top scientists.
James Hansen, put there by Ronald Reagan.
it doesn't matter. James Hansen has taken all this money from environmental special lobbying groups. Would you be happy if NASA's top scientists had taken money from oil and gas? The point is, James Hansen...
Mark,
let me
just ask you, you just asked a rhetorical question, but let me just toss one back at you. Do you really think that people on either side of this argument, or on both sides of this argument, are primarily motivated by money?
Oh, absolutely not. But my point, though, is, you know, you'll hear Al Gore, Laurie David, ABC's Bill Blakemore. Everyone says any skeptical scientist must be a stooge of the oil and gas industry. That's the only reason it's relevant, if you're going to mention it.
But do you think those people are motivated by money?
Who? I mean, there's always...
Al Gore, Laurie David...
Oh, no, that's an ideology to them, absolutely. I mean, that's a belief in ideology. They're very sincere. I would never say... What's that?
And science.
That is extremely debatable. I mean, when you have the New York Times smacking down Al Gore for his science exaggerations on everything from whether we're in the warmest period of the last 1,000 years to whether Mount Kilimanjaro's ice is melting to just a whole series
of... It was not the New York Times slapping him down. It was one of you guys writing in the New York Times slapping him down.
No. This was a New York Times reporter, and actually they quoted some skeptical scientists, but they actually quoted friends of Al Gore, and they actually, the New York Times did their own research. If you go back and look at that, I believe a March 12th and March 13th article. My point being, the United Nations claims to have the consensus of scientists. First of all, the actual report hasn't changed much in 2007 from 2001. The only thing that's really changed is the alarming summary. Are you aware that Reuters News reported that there were only 56 scientists at the last UN IPC summary, at least the one in January? And this is where they claim 2,500 of the world's top scientists are involved. Well, that includes Pat Michaels, a skeptical scientist, Fred Singer. It's included Richard Lindzen. It includes John Christie. All these are skeptics. My point is only 56 actual scientists showed up. It was a political document they produced. And as far as this latest NASA press release, just once again...
It was a political document because this requires politics to solve this problem.
Well,
you're working in a political world, too. You're the communications director for Jim Imhoff's committee, for his office. I mean, the politics is how we solve problems in
Democratic
Republic.
Right, but I'm saying they presented a science scenario that was done by only 56 scientists were involved, and the rest of them, hundreds of political delegates and UN bureaucrats. And hear about this one for a shocker. A Greenpeace advisor, Bill Hare, was a co-author of the key economic report of the UN last week. Would you have been silent, sitting by, if ExxonMobil had been a key author of a key UN report? My point to you,
Mark, are you saying that ExxonMobil's voice is not being heard in this debate?
I'm saying that there's not fairness.
I think their voice is being heard very loudly in this debate.
Okay, if you want to talk about that, $19 million ExxonMobil is supposedly given to groups skeptical of climate, catastrophic man-made global warming. Compare that to the tens of billions that the climate, promoters of climate alarmism have gotten, and it's just not even a... It's not
tens
even
of billions?
Anyway, the only reason skeptics are so successful is they
Who
have
got
so
a billion dollars?
Side.
Who got a billion dollars, Mark?
Who got a billion dollars? There's a study out. I think the Australian government alone is putting billions into some new climate study. Antarctic study just came out. Antarctica study, just billions of dollars. The U.S.
So you're opposed to the funding of science.
The U.S. spends almost $6 billion a year in this research, predominantly going to people promoting fears of a coming climate catastrophe.
So you're... Well, Australia is doing it because they're experiencing one of the worst droughts in history. They're concerned that they're not going to be able to feed themselves next year.
Augie Auger, one of their top meteorologists, is actually calling to task a couple scientists in Australia, because I believe the average temperatures there's a dispute over the temperature there. But the point is, everything in the New York Times said it best. All recent weather events can be explained, are all within natural climate variability. That was Andrew Revkin, April 2006, New York Times. He said very few scientists disagree with that. So the bottom line is, everything you're seeing, Hurricane Katrina, according to the New York Times, is all within natural variability. So all you have are unproven computer models of the future.
Because one guy says one thing in the New York Times doesn't make it so, Mark. You would be the first to say that.
I'm talking about an article.
You're using individual anecdotes to refute the consensus view of the world's climatologists. So I'm frankly a little amazed here, Mark, because I was expecting you to come on and say, as your news release does, that cap and trade is a lousy way to control carbon.
Okay,
and that's what I was prepared to discuss with you and debate with you, because I actually have read this report by the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, which you're attacking.
Let's set aside the science. let's set aside the science. I'll agree with you on that. Let's just, it's not an issue right now. Let's assume we want to tackle this.
Well, we're not going to agree on it. We've had this debate before, but you suggest that the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, that their report says that cap and trade, which is basically putting a price on emissions of carbon and letting companies turning it into a commodity where companies can buy the right to pollute from companies that pollute less, and where ultimately at the end of the day it becomes progressively more and more expensive to pollute with carbon dioxide, that you're saying that the CBO is saying that that's a bad thing.
I'm saying they identified a series of difficulties with CO2 that would require major addressing issues, and with cap and trade, I'm sorry, that would require major issues to address. I'm talking about a transfer of wealth from poor to rich. We're talking about job losses. We're talking about an inefficient way of doing it. The bottom line, and the CBO basically echoes this, if you're looking for the way not to handle limits on CO2, why would you look at the Kyoto Protocol model of cap and trade? Why would you look at cap and trade when it's an utter complete disaster in Europe, 13 to 15 EU nations not meeting it. Canada just withdrew their environmental minister.
I think it doesn't go anywhere near far enough.
Well,
the actual CBO study says the merit of cap and trade program is that, like a tax on CO2 emissions, it would motivate businesses and households to reduce emissions in the least costly ways. Such programs have been used successfully in the United States to limit the cost of reducing emissions of other air pollutants, such as lead and gasoline and nitrogen oxides and sulfur dioxide from electricity generators. It does say that it's going to raise the cost of energy, which will be a regressive tax. It's going to hit the poorer harder than everybody else because they also have to pay for energy. And it also says, in addition, investors in parts of the energy sector would be likely to experience losses. In other words, ExxonMobil stockholders are going to be hurt. But, you know, what else do you want to do? I mean, I would suggest going to a full-blown carbon tax. Mark, can you stick around for a minute?
Sure.
Can you stick around?
Sure.
Stick around over the break, because I'd like to just get a little farther in this conversation with you. And you know, the clock starts, and we just do have to take a break. We're talking with Mark Morano. He is the communications director for the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, James Inhofe's staff, epw.senate.gov. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Demand is up, supplies are down. What I want is light, crude and brown. I crave oil to get my kicks, attack the rack to get my fix. I love oil, oh, every ounce. Nuclear, I can't pronounce. When my twins go out for fun, I say don't drive, take Air Force One. Oh, we can't conserve it, we are just way too spoiled. Oh, yeah.
Mark Morano with us on James Inhofe's staff. He's the communications director for the Senate Minority. It used to be the communications director for the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. Now you're sort of the number two communications director. How does that work, Mark?
That's exactly right. There's a majority communications director and now a minority. I'm the minority one. So.
Okay, great. Just wanted to get it right here because I think we're using an old bio of yours.
Okay.
Just to get this straight,
ourselves down, have a calm, rational discussion, and
right.
Walk through this. Thank you.
Right, and the music is going to begin again at 27 minutes past, and that's a hard break at the bottom. Well, they're all hard breaks, but we have to make this fairly short. But, you know, I'm not going to convince you, apparently, that 80% of global warming is man-made and 20% is solar, and you're not going to convince me that 20% is man-made and 80% is solar, and, you know, which I think is, you know, one of the cleavages. It seems that you're suggesting that cap and trade shouldn't be done because nothing should be done. Is that right?
Well, no, that's not correct at all. Let me give you a simple way. If we were facing a climate catastrophe, let's say we all agree on that, regardless of any scientific dispute, would cap and trade be a way you'd go about handling it? And that's what our point here, Senator Inhofe's point, is even if we were facing one, which he does not believe, that would not be the way to go about it.
How would you do it?
Sign on to something called the Asia-Pacific Partnership. As you know, Kyoto and all these other cap-and-trade schemes do not bring in China, India, the developing nations. The Asia-Pacific Partnership is a technology-sharing bill, which I think is 2005. It came forth. We're still getting signers. I believe Canada is now talking about joining it. We've got all the developed nations on it, South Korea, India, China, other nations. The idea being this brings them in. It brings in the latest technology. It brings in sharing of that technology. Because if you look to the future, the only way you're ever going to get to renewables, the only way you're going to get off a dependence on fossil fuels, and there's plenty of reasons to want to do it. Not that CO2 is not a pollutant, but there's other pollution issues involved. There's also, you know, national security interests involved. The way to do it is through technology. As anyone who credibly looks at this, the question is, and I think a lot of people are trying to use cap and trade to force companies, businesses to sort of jumpstart them. But the problem is, it is such an inefficient, bureaucratic, and just woeful way of going about it. As the CBO study said, it's going to impact the poor among us. In fact, there's a study of homeless families, and one of the top three reasons, next to alcoholism and other issues, was the
divorce. I think is number two.
Yeah, one of them was the cost of home energy. That was one of the reasons they were forced out of their home. That was cited as one of the top three reasons. The point being, this is not the way to go about it. All you have to do is truly look at Kyoto and look at what's happening in Europe. There's no reason we could look at that and say, hey, that looks like a disaster. Let's try it here. That's the number one complaint here. Aside from the
science. I don't disagree with you that it would be a fine thing if we were to throw a whole lot of money into a Manhattan-style project to develop new technologies and make them widely available. I'm not sure that that's exactly what you're recommending, but technology, yes, is going to be part of the solution. But cap and trade is really a form of taxation. And what we've done...
It's an inefficient form. You mentioned carbon tax. That would be, if you were looking at taxes, that would be a much more effective and streamlined
tax. And that, which is why I'm an advocate of it, frankly. But nonetheless, I mean, we have a long history in this country. We have a long history in this country of using taxes to drive policy. We give tax deductions for home mortgages to encourage people to buy homes. We give companies tax deductions up to, I think it's $120,000 a year now, for equipment purchases for small companies in order to encourage them to invest in equipment. I mean, we allow R&D to be written off in ways that we don't allow other things to be written off. So, you know, what's wrong with using taxation policy, cap and trade, among other things, as a way of encouraging companies to do the right thing?
Well, first of all, it's intellectually dishonest. Not that that's a shocking thing to say about something coming out of Washington.
I think everybody's pretty upfront about what it is.
Well, the point is, though, let's look at a carbon tax. That would be a much more efficient way. But the problem is, and you can be for it.
Well, cap and trade actually is a carbon tax.
Well, but it's not called that, and it's not essentially, you know, there's an implication.
It's a more flexible one. It's one that allows companies to make the transition more slowly if they need to, and which is frankly why I don't absolutely love it, but I think it's a start.
Well, Senator Boxer has this current bill out called the Global Warming Pollution Reduction Act, which, by the way, CO2 is not a pollutant. But aside from that, this bill would, according to an MIT study just released, this is not, you know, the GOP study, but MIT, it would cost the American family of four $4,500 per family by 2015 per year. So the question is, what are you going to get for that
benefit? But this is the problem with the CBO study, too. The CBO study talks about the cost of cap and trade. It doesn't talk about the cost of global warming. It doesn't talk about the costs of the cancers caused by using fossil fuels. I mean, it doesn't talk about the externalities.
Fair enough. Bring this up. Senator Bingaman from New Mexico has a bill out as well. There's about over a dozen, actually, between the House and Senate. His bill, and this was in the Washington Post. I know you don't like me quoting newspapers. I'm not cherry-picking. I'm just telling you, this is the definitive word. I think it was the Energy Commission that came up with this. His bill would not have any impact on the climate. Many of these bills would have an undetectable impact, just as Kyoto. So the American people are being asked to pay $4,500, $3,500 a year for no gain, other and symbolism so politicians can pat themselves on the back and say we did something. That's why I think this is not going to sell in Washington. This is the paper house of cards.
Mark got to wrap it up. EPW.Senate.gov. Mark Morano, thanks for being with us.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
don't know end in sight. Mission's accomplished, everything's alright. He's busy reading my best note. How the hell did he get your book? Never saw no web, that's what the experts say. W wasn't listening, let's bomb him anyway. While you're searching under every stone and log, you nearly hit a prisoner, chain him like a dog. Never saw no web, that's what the experts say. W wasn't listening, let's bomb him anyway.
Call 858-292-2000 if you're in that neck of the woods for more information. If you want to drop by and say hi, I will be giving a little talk and signing books and saying hi, and be a fine thing to meet folks there and get to know what's going on in San Diego, to see San Diego. It's been a while. I am looking. Man, I have to fix some buttons here. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Morgan in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morgan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Nice to talk with you, first-time caller.
Thank you for calling.
I kind of wanted to, you know, you mentioned Ireland, and I spent a month last year in Ireland, and I know you're on this subject of global warming, but it kind of underscores what's happening around the world. You know, its economy has increased, you know, incredibly, and yet the old system of caring about your neighbor is lost. And I think that's endemic of what's happening. I think that the fact that global warming has been so politicized is because we're pandering to greed and not, you know, considering that we're a global village anymore.
Interesting. It's a good point. Increasingly, we're not thinking of ourselves around the world, we, the human race, and frankly, all life. We're not thinking of ourselves as a we anymore. There's an us and a them. And that's a very good point. Thank you, Morgan. Jackie in West Essex, New York. Hey, Jackie.
Tom, first-time caller.
Thank you.
You're a blessing. I'm sitting here thinking there are 192 nations in the UN. All we need is half that number to translate your program into the native language of half the nations, we would win by truth and counter all the propaganda on all of the other, I wanted to say right-wing, anyway, my thought on global warming, and I meant that sincerely,
thanks.
And I don't call shows, really, but I was moved to call today for a couple of reasons. Your program is one of dialogue. I notice when those who call in to counter standards to address global warming hardly give you a moment to speak. The latter part of your program was the best part of all because he kind of simmered down a bit. But why can't there be a little of each? Why do they take time to cost out what a bill that the House wants now to set standards and not care an ounce about what we are spending in Iraq, what we have done to the deficit, what we have done to our standing around the world, cutting everything and not even addressing the poor needs of our returning soldiers. So, I mean, it's totally out of whack that they go overboard with all this cost analysis of that. You know what that would cost? They don't take any time to do the same, have the same approach with the other legislation.
Yeah. Well,
do you feel that way?
I do, Jackie, and you made your point well, and I appreciate it. And I would say that there is a cost analysis here in global warming and the whole climate thing, and frankly, fossil fuels. I mean, let's just really face this, that if we were to take the cost of cancers, just cancers and lung diseases caused by the burning of fossil fuels that would not be caused if we were burning renewable energy or if we were using solar power to drive our vehicles or if we had good public transportation systems. Just the cancers and lung diseases caused by fossil fuels. If you added that cost that is being picked up by you and me through our employer-paid insurance, through our personally paid insurance, through Medicare, through Medicaid, through our taxpayer-paid insurance, if you were to take that cost and add it to the cost of a gallon of gasoline instead and say, okay, it's going to be paid for by its source, it would add another $4 a gallon to gasoline. You'd have $8 a gallon gas. I mean, or seven and change. And so, yeah, we're not considering all the costs, first of all. I'm not sure I would conflate the, you know, Mark and I were debating carbon dioxide. But the other point that he was making is that if you can't get a perfect bill, why have any bill at all? And this is one of the strategies that is used to try and kill anything in its tracks. And I'm saddened to hear that Inhofe is and the so-called skeptics are taking that position that, we're all in favor of change, but this isn't enough change, so we're going to do away with it. Sorry, any small step is better than nothing, in my opinion. I'd love to see a beginning. I'm far more radical on this than anybody in Congress, as far as I know. Probably Bernie Sanders we haven't talked about specific legislation, but I think that, you know, we should be looking at a carbon tax, and we should be looking at a Manhattan-style project where we put a couple $100 billion, like half the cost of the Iraq war, into solarizing this entire country, the way the Germans did. And it's working. Andrew in New York City. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to point out, if you want to find the key lie in their spiel, look for the thing that's most repeated. And in his case, it was carbon dioxide is not a pollutant. Carbon dioxide is not a pollutant, which is it's a weasel, as Al Franken would have said. But in a very real sense, it is a pollutant in the sense that it's degrading our environment and make it difficult for us to survive.
Yeah, I mean their position on it is that it's not a pollutant because we breathe in oxygen and we exhale carbon dioxide, as all animals do, and plants inhale carbon dioxide and exhale oxygen. That is part of that normal cycle. But you're absolutely right. When we're looking at atmospheric carbon dioxide levels that have gone from, you know, a couple hundred, two to 300 parts per million after the first century of the Industrial Revolution, up pushing 400 or 500 parts per million. I mean, just massive increases in carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, and it's modifying our atmosphere. And by any measure, I think, by any scientific measure, you could call that a pollutant. Let's see, Bob in Eureka, California. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, good. I really love the way you let these people expose themselves for the idiots they are. But they still leave me completely apoplectic with their lies and false equivalencies. And the idea that some environmental scientist who has been studying straight on through from high school biology all the way through college, master's degree, and understanding the full range of scientific method is somehow trying to stop business by saying, look, there's a problem here.
But it fits in nicely with the conservative conspiracy theory that all liberals are trying to destroy the rich, or trying to destroy business, or whatever.
Tom, you're
or whatever.
A businessman. I'm a
yeah.
businessman.
No,
I'm also
you know,
a long-haired hippie freak. You
yeah,
know?
I don't know any liberals, well, actually maybe one, who are anti-business or strongly anti-capitalism. By and large, you know, all of us agree that this is an economic system that works somewhat, but it does need regulation. We do
absolutely.
Need the Sherman Act.
Absolutely.
We do.
It occurred to me while I was waiting that I graduated from Naval Nuclear Power School 33 years ago this month.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my ability to understand standard deviation and chemistry and the math of the global climate problem is right there. And these guys are just liars. Jim Inhofe is a liar. That Mark dude, he's a liar. Just
well, one,
flat
you know,
out liar. And he
yeah.
deserves no respect. They are liars. The science that tells you that nuclear power works is the same science that tells you carbon dioxide overabundance is a pollutant. Come on, it's just so simple. It's finite
yeah.
mathematics.
Yeah.
It's not hard to understand.
Okay, point well made, Bob. And although I'm just very reluctant to call Mark a liar. First of all, he's not here to defend himself, and secondly, I think that there are people who they actually believe this stuff. I mean, they get into it deep enough that they actually believe it. I also think that there are people who are promoting this, who are liars, who are and principally within industry because they have a large economic interest at stake. But you know. Who knows? Ira in Tannersville, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ira.
Hi. pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks.
I think the question is, that has to be asked, is what happens if you're wrong? If you get too excited about global warming, and it turns out it isn't as bad as it looks, then you've spent some money unnecessarily. But if you don't get excited enough about global warming, and it's worse than you think it is, that's the end of life on Earth.
Yeah, that's the point that I made the last time Mark and I had this argument, and his response was that there's not enough evidence to be spending that money is going to have a negative impact on the economy, and in their cost-benefit analysis, it's just not worth it. I disagree with
that. He's rolling dice
with our
children's lives.
I absolutely agree, and it's very well said. Yeah, how dare him? Very well said, Ira, and right across the board, all of these so-called skeptics or deniers, and that needs to be the issue. Ira just said it so well that what if they're right? If they're right, then we've spent something that's maybe a third of what we spent just on the war and occupation of Iraq. If they're wrong, a lot of people are going to die. And the fact of the matter is that people are dying right now because of global warming. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line, talkradionews.com. Ellen Marr in Eagle Rock has some thoughts about the funding bill. First of all, hi, Ellen.
Hi.
let's bring Marr in for just a quick comment. Hey, Marr.
Hi. I wanted to ask you, Tom, first of all, I adore you. You're brilliant. I learned so much from you and from Randy Rhodes. Thank God we have you on KTLK in Los Angeles. And I wanted to ask your listeners and change the topic briefly, although go wind and solar power, we need them desperately. We need electric cars. But in the next hour or two, Congress is going to be voting on the Iraq supplemental funding bill. And I would like to ask everyone to call the number you always give out, Tom, 202-225-2131. Give your zip code.
No, it's 3121. 225-3121.
Oh, so I did have it right the first time. Okay, yeah. 3121 in the 202 area code. And talk to your representative. I'm asking everyone to say no, ask their rep to vote no on this bill, because people are not aware that there's a provision in the bill for privatization of 80% of Iraqi oil, leaving 20% to be divided three ways. This is immoral. In addition
you're
to
talking about the production sharing agreements.
Pardon me?
Because you're talking about the production sharing agreements. The benchmark for the Iraqi government to adopt the PSAs where the oil companies put in the pay for the development of the oil fields and then the government gets 17% of the revenue. Is that what you're talking about?
No, there's a provision in there that demands that 80% become privatized, but become corporate.
Right. I think we're talking about the same thing, but it was 83%, as I recall. But in any case, so you're opposed to this legislation. That's interesting.
Also opposed because, first of all, it's immoral to be stealing their natural resources from them.
Sure.
That's not for us to do. And actually, the other day, Congressman Kucinich asked for that provision to be taken out of the bill. They told him they would. They did not. And then they put a lock on it that no more changes could be made.
Interesting.
So in addition to that, funding, any kind of funding whatsoever, reauthorizes the war all over again. We will never get out of war until we cut the purse strings. We do not need to give one more dollar. There's $70 billion in the pipeline to start bringing the troops home now. Yeah. We've got to stop.
Bush has a smokescreen.
Constitutionally, Congress...
Got it.
Congress,
Congress has, every 2 years, they have to reauthorize. Yes, they have total power of the purse strings. I agree. And we're almost out of time here, and I got to bring Ellen Ratner. Thank you, Mar, for your point. Ellen, your thoughts on what Mar said and what's going on in Congress right now.
Well, I think this is... I applaud Congressman Kucinich. I think that he's trying to stay on top of it, and I think it's great. I have not read the fine print, so I'm not going to comment on something that I don't know intimately, but I do know that, of course, the oil revenues are very important to that country getting back on its feet without us, which is interesting because today there was a draft resolution, I guess it was actually late yesterday, from the El Sadr contingent, but apparently it has 144 of the 275 members of the parliament's signature in Iraq for a timetable for our eventual withdrawal from Iraq.
Right.
So,
in other words, the majority of the Iraqi parliament has said to us, get your timetable together, guys, and start packing.
Exactly. And today the president met with the Joint Chiefs. He started to talk about the additional Iraqi brigades, the additional American brigades. He said we should be able to agree, this is what he said, all of us, the Republicans and Democrats, on the consequences of failure in Iraq, and it would be disastrous for our country to have failure. He said he wants, his attitude to Congress is, why don't you wait and see what he, i.e. Petraeus, says. He also said that he talked to members, the Republican members, about what it meant to fail. And he, for the first time, mentioned benchmarks. So, you know, maybe 1% into the Bush psyche, but it's 1%.
Do you think this is the result of? Do you think this is the result of the Gang of 11? These 11 Republican members of Congress meeting with him yesterday and speaking very bluntly to him in a way that apparently even his own cabinet won't do. Everybody's afraid of losing their head if they talk like this to him.
I certainly think it had its effect.
Yeah.
He also said that Congress is ready to fund unrelated domestic spending at 100% and only 50% for those that wear the uniform. So he's doing his fighting words on that.
He's trying to play politics with us.
And you know what's so interesting is the talking points that the RNC's been sending out to the talk show hosts are that the Democrats are playing all the politics with Iraq.
Yeah, I get them.
I know.
Yes, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
I have to deal with all these talk show hosts I'm on with every day. Mr. Gonzalez was before the House Judiciary Committee. He said he has not remembered any significant details, that his feelings and recollections about this matter have not changed. That's what he
said. Hasn't he had time from his testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee until now? Hasn't he had time to go back and, like, look at his appointment logs, read his notes, refresh his memory?
I guess his memory doesn't refresh.
I think this is a version of the Fifth Amendment defense. He's saying, I don't remember, because this is how Reagan got it. Reagan said, I don't remember, 156 times in one piece of testimony when he was deposed on Iran-Contra.
He did.
And part of that's probably attributable to Alzheimer's, but I think the majority of it was that his lawyers said, if you say yes or if you say no, if you say the truth, then you may be admitting to a crime. If you say a lie, you may be committing perjury. But if you say, I don't remember, they can't charge you with either one.
That's exactly right.
It's the down the middle
clever
way to go.
He's clever. You got to say that for him.
Yeah, he and Rove and the people who are prepping him, and I guess John Roberts, I guess, used to prep people for the White House. Certainly in 2000 was prepping the people who were arguing before the Supreme Court in Bush v. Gore. They don't have him to do that anymore, but they've got somebody as good. Ellen Ratner, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Dwight Eisenhower, back in 1953, April 16, 1953, warned America of what would happen if there was an absolute conflation of commercial interests and war interests. Speaking to the American Society of Newspaper Editors in Washington, D.C., Ike said,
"Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this."
And then he goes through and lists what literally the cost of one modern heavy bomber is.
"A modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is 2 electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is 2 fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people."
And then Eisenhower says, "This is no way to live.
This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron."
And Eisenhower, of course, the man who coined the phrase, the military-industrial complex. Bob Bauman has written, co-authored with Dana Racer, with a foreword by Jonathan Alter, probably the definitive book on what has come about as a consequence of the vision that Eisenhower warned us of. And, in fact, the blurb on the back of the book starts out, "President Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex." Robert Bauman, Bob Bauman, followthemoneyproject.org, the website, the book, "Betraying Our Troops, The Destructive Results of Privatizing War." Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you with us. Tell us the destructive results of privatizing war. First of all, I don't think that most Americans realize that the extent to which we have privatized the war and then the subsequent occupation of Iraq as compared to previous efforts.
No, in fact, what the Iraq War and Afghanistan War has done was create a whole new defense industry. We call it the war service industry, and it has firmly rooted itself into the system now, and this particular industry now requires a hot war, occupation, and even natural disasters in order to operate. And what's really kind of frightening about all this is that this particular industry needs to keep going. It has become so firmly rooted that there are just literally hundreds of billions of dollars involved in all the hundreds of contracts that feed into this war.
This is an industry that has trade conferences about and shows and displays about how war can be done. This is an industry that, you know, the army is collapsible, expandable. If we're not during time of war, we don't induct as many people into the military. We can close down bases. We've done that. Jefferson took us from a couple hundred thousand people in the military, men in the military, to as I recall, between 3,000 and 6,000. And then, you know, it got ramped back up again for the War of 1812. I mean, we've been doing this throughout the history of the United States. But industries tend to resist that. If you have an auto industry, they don't like to be downsized. If you have a shoe industry, they don't, you know, whatever it may be. I mean, fill in the blank, a steel industry, people don't like losing their jobs. They don't, you know, it's a whole different kind of thing here, a different kind of animal.
Yeah, the war service industry is just what it is. It's a service industry as opposed to the traditional military industrial complex, which likes to bend metal and let it rust, and it's essentially a whole series of production plants build bombers and other weapon systems. This is a service industry. They're out there in the hot war, and they need a hot war, as I mentioned, and an occupation or something like that in order to continue its existence. And they've gained a lot of high influence within the administration, within Congress. They've poured a lot of money into lobbying efforts to create this influence. And that influence, of course, is to gain more contracts and also, we think, to affect policy.
Why would conservatives in Congress and in the White House who give lip service to being tightwads with the public purse be more enthusiastic about spending $150,000 a year on a private soldier from a private army to go over to Iraq or Afghanistan, as opposed to spending $20,000, $30,000, maybe $40,000, when you consider all the costs of support and everything in addition to salary, for a soldier who's actually a member of the army?
Well, that's a complex answer, but I think at first, I don't think Congress really realizes the cost. The Pentagon sold this whole idea on two factors. One is that by privatizing war functions, that it would be more economical, that it would be more efficient, because they can utilize a business model rather than a government model. And secondly, it would allow more troops to be trigger pullers and take them. In other words, you have to have a certain number that would be in support of the combat units, and now you can put more into the combat units. But that didn't exactly work out that way, because contractors are running the supply lines. That means they're driving the convoys. They're doing the security that normally the military would do, but it takes the military to guard the contractors. It also takes the military to watch them on the bases. It takes the military to take over when the contractors refuse to drive, when drivers quit. They don't want to go out into the hostile areas. And so the Army has to take over and do the job. So it's really taking more trigger pullers, if you will, to return to the support areas in order to support the contractors.
How do we, as a people, we the people, you know, what message do we communicate to our representatives to try to head off a situation where we have an industry that's driven by profit, and it can only make its profit if there are wars around the world, and therefore will naturally advocate for war? How do we prevent the harm that causes? I mean, do we criminalize the industry? Do we say you may not make a private army? It's illegal to have but then, you know, at a certain level, there's some services, I suppose, that the military needs. I mean, what's the remedy to this?
Well, the remedy really is, I think it'll be somewhat distasteful to the war service industry, but Congress needs to put a governor on all this. First of all, the Congress has to realize that contractors and the corporate mentality does not work on the battlefield. They're in complete conflict to the Army's mission, and it just does not work. It creates just way too many problems. I can go into a lot of them. The book certainly goes into the major problems that it does create for the troops. Secondly,
for example,
drivers. Let's say that you have all the drivers that are taking these transporting supplies to the troops. Critical life support supplies, as well as combat fighting equipment. There is no legal basis to compel them to do the job. They can quit whenever they want. They can quit on the battlefield. They can quit and say, "I don't want to go out there."
Well, and in fact, we had a woman on this program whose son was killed because Halliburton was refusing to deliver the mail from the Baghdad airport to where his base was because it was too dangerous, and so he had to drive to the airport to get his mail, and he was killed on the way.
Right. Well, that's an example. And so what happens there is that the supply chain, which used to be strictly a military function, and I'm talking about the supply chain out there where the bullets fly and the bombs go off, it was strictly a military function. You can count on them when they are compelled to perform. If they don't, they can be court-martialed, they can go to prison, all sorts of things. Now, a civilian employee of a corporation has the right to quit the job.
Right. And so it's just it's a whole different thing.
Yeah,
there
is no reliability out there. It's so commanders don't have command and control over the supply chain.
Right. Betraying Our Troops is the title of the book, The Destructive Results of Privatizing War. Dina Racer and Robert Bauman, the authors, followthemoneyproject.org, the website. Bob, thanks for being with us today.
It was a pleasure.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. The House Armed Services Committee, I believe Ike Skelton is the chairman of that, I might be wrong, he has dealt a blow to the human rights community by failing to include provisions to overhaul GOP legislation governing military tribunals. This would be in the 2007 John Warner Defense Authorization Bill, as I recall, in the new 2008 Defense Authorization Bill. Skelton and Nancy Pelosi say they intend to bring a standalone habeas bill to the floor because habeas corpus is not being protected now ever since the John Warner Defense Authorization Bill of 2007. Jonathan Hafetz is with us. Am I pronouncing that right, Jonathan?
Yeah, Hafetz.
Hafetz, thank you very much. He's the litigation director for Liberty and National Security Project at the Brennan Center for Justice and counsel to several detainees held by the United States government, presumably down at Guantanamo?
Yes, and elsewhere.
And elsewhere. Brennan Center, BRENNANCENTER.org, the website. Jonathan, we have lost habeas corpus in the United States.
Well, it appears to be that way. The Congress, in a statute passed late last year, shortly before midterm elections, eliminated habeas corpus rights. The target was principally detainees at Guantanamo, to strip them of this most fundamental right, which allows individuals to access to a court, a neutral decision maker, to determine if there's a basis for their detention. And it's a right that we've had since the founding of this country.
Now, how can that be done when the Constitution itself, Article 1, Section 9, says the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless in cases of rebellion or invasion?
Well,
I mean, how is it even possible that they did that, much less,
well, I think it's,
you know,
I certainly agree. I think it contradicts that clause or provision of the Constitution known as the suspension clause, which prohibits eliminating habeas corpus absent a proper suspension. And I all agree there was no suspension in the statute. The argument that was put forward by the supporters of the legislation by the administration is that detainees at Guantanamo do not have any rights under the Constitution. So the upshot of this is that they could be
held. But the Constitution doesn't say citizens. It says persons. I mean, throughout the Constitution.
Well, that's correct. The Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment specifically refers to persons. The Suspension Clause.
The 14th Amendment?
That's right. The suspension clause of the Constitution does not refer specifically to citizens, and it's long been the case that that foreign nationals or non-citizens have a right to habeas corpus,
and this is also recognized by international law. I mean, the United Nations. I mean, this habeas corpus. For our listeners who don't know what habeas corpus is, it basically. Well, you give me a quick definition here, Jonathan. You're the expert on this stuff.
I mean, habeas corpus is a ancient writ, which literally means that you have the body. But basically, it requires the government to answer to a court when it's depriving someone of its liberty. And it's at its essence, it is the ultimate safeguard to prevent the president, or in the old days the king, from locking someone away without proof, without a hearing, without any kind of determination about whether or not they have the right person. I mean, this is right. This is what stands between, you know, the United States and a police state. I mean, this
so
is the most core right.
Yeah, absolutely, and it was first came into being in a big way in 1215 on the field of Runnymede in northern England, when King John was forced by the feudal barons to sign the Magna Carta, and you know, then reincarnated in the 1600s in the first British Habeas Corpus Act. But in any case, the Armed Services Committee has not put habeas corpus back into the next defense authorization bill. Are the Democrats committed to bringing us a standalone habeas bill to the floor? Is this going to happen?
Well, all the indications have been that we've had it, that Democrats are, you know, are committed, and a number of Republicans are. This measure to strip habeas passed by only the narrowest of margins. It was really about two votes in the Senate. So the question is what vehicle it will be brought under. But I think, as has been made clear, to the Democrats in Congress and to others, this is a top priority, and they, you know, they need to get this done. They need to get habeas restored and to get America back on the right track.
Yeah, the people should be out there speaking out, and you can call Congress at 202-225-3121. Plus, you guys have a Constitution Project event coming up May 17th in Washington, D.C. No charge for that event. You want to give it just a quick plug to it here?
Sure. It's going to be a terrific event talking about the court stripping provisions of the Military Commissions Act, and we have including a number of speakers, former Court of Appeals Judge Patricia Wald, William Howard Taft IV, who was formerly in the State Department, will be speaking, and also William Kubler, who is a military defense counsel and will be counsel in one of the upcoming military trials, and myself will all be speaking and explaining the importance of habeas corpus, and not just to American values, but also to an effective counterterrorism strategy. I mean, what's fundamental to realize is that these provisions don't make us safer either.
Yeah. Losing habeas corpus doesn't make us safer. In fact, it makes us less safe, arguably. And this is all at the National Press Club. You can find out all about it over at BrennanCenter.org. Jonathan Hafitz, Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you.
Keep up the great work, sir. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. Listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, supported by you, listening for local sponsors that you can support, letting them know that you're listening to the program and using their products, plus our national sponsors, Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time at sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics at smalldog.com, and the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECO-WINE. Congressman Earl Blumenauer from the 3rd District of Oregon, what Stephen Colbert last night referred to as the ugliest district.
Ouch, Tom.
I know. He was so nice to you when you went on. He didn't even make you hold a sausage like he did to Brian Baird. Anyhow, Congressman, great to have you with us. You are, along with a few other members of Congress, as I recall, the congresswoman from California, refresh my memory, introducing this.
This is Jan Schakowsky from Chicago.
Jan Schakowsky.
And
from Chicago, yes.
And Chris Shays, Republican from Connecticut.
Right. Introducing a piece of legislation to allow up to 15,000 Iraqis and their families to enter the U.S. legally each year for the next 4 years. Right now, what is the situation? We go over to their country, we blow it up, we basically open the gates of hell, and then we say, and then when they say to us, "Oh, you're here to help us," well, you know, those of us who have helped you guys who are really at risk, both sides are taking aim at them. Can we come live at in your country? We say no. Is that about what's going on?
It's unfortunately, your thumbnail sketch is too accurate. This is the scene of, other than Darfur, the greatest humanitarian crisis in the world today. We have 4 million Iraqis who've been uprooted from their homes, 2 million that have had to move around in other places in Iraq, 2 million that have fled the country already, 50 to 70,000 more people each month. And the United States has basically slammed the door on people, as you say, whose lives are at risk because they helped Americans. Since October, the great United States of America that did unleash this horrible series of events in Iraq has allowed only 69 Iraqi refugees, only one last month. It's absolutely outrageous. I've been working with some people in Oregon. Actually, there was a high school class, some of the Oregon National Guard members who tried to get their interpreter out, a young woman whose life was definitely at risk, and it took months to jump through the hurdles and get her here to safety. This is something that I feel, no matter what their idea is about the war in Iraq or where they think it's going, they ought to be able to unite to give simple justice to these refugees.
What kind of support or resistance are you getting in Congress to this idea?
Well, actually, we've just started circulating the information this week. There have been a number of newspaper and magazine articles, reports that are coming out, and we're finding that there are a number of people who just simply, it wasn't on their radar screen. They didn't realize, unless they had direct experience in their district, they didn't realize how bad it was. And I'm finding significant expressions of support. We've got a number of international organizations that are stepping up. We even, actually, the Iraqi ambassador to the United States wasn't able to get to our press conference this morning, but submitted a statement in support of it. I think we're going to be able to make a difference here.
That's great. That's great. I'm curious about Jan Schakowsky is one of your co-sponsors on this from Chicago, and she also just recently came out in support of Denis Kucinich's suggestion or his bill to impeach Dick Cheney. There are only four supporters of that in Congress right now. I was a big supporter of impeachment for a long time, and I'm beginning actually to become ambivalent about it. I'm concerned that George Bush and Dick Cheney aren't the problem anymore. It's the Republican Party and the organized crime element within it. I mean that quite seriously.
Many of your Republican colleagues
are good people. Ron Paul is a man of the highest integrity, for example. He's been on this program, and I have a lot of respect for him. I disagree with him, but I have a lot of respect for him. But there are other elected officials. Probably a few Democrats as well, but in particular a number of Republicans who are behaving in ways that we used to see in movies about the mafia. And I think that needs to be pointed out. And I'm just curious what your take is on Jan Schakowsky's support of Denis Kucinich and where you are at on that.
I have felt all along that if Congress started to exercise its legitimate oversight function and holding these people accountable for everything from abuses for contracting in Iraq to what I think is a scandal that is of significant proportion that is growing in terms of the interference with the administration of justice, with Alberto Gonzalez and the firing of U.S. attorneys, that we would set the table for, in some cases, there will be prosecution. We've already seen, you know, there are 8 members of Congress on the Republican side of the aisle that are under investigation. Tom DeLay was whining in the newspapers yesterday about the zealousness of the FBI.
Yeah, he's compared himself to Jesus Christ.
It's
beyond bizarre.
We have a situation where we've had a number of officials in the Bush administration now that are resigning. You know, I think the spotlight on the actual performance that the investigation work that Henry Waxman and other committees are doing is really turning up the heat and is making a difference. As a practical matter, there is so much support still from the Republican base and the Republicans in the Senate that an impeachment activity would go nowhere. And if I'm Karl Rove, I would rather change the subject to impeachment that's not going to go anywhere rather than have the searchlight on activities that lead actually to my office, Karl Rove, as well as others. So from my vantage point, I'd like us to keep the heat. I'd like us to do our job with oversight. I'd like us to lead these activities along to wherever the evidence takes us. And I think it's going to continue to show more and more results. It's made a difference already.
Yeah, and who knows where it'll lead. I mean,
when
the 33 years ago when the House Judiciary Committee voted to subpoena the White House tapes, only one of the Republicans voted in favor of that, and 4 months later, virtually all of the, not all, but nearly all the Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee voted in favor of articles of impeachment against Nixon once they heard the evidence.
It's a very important point, Tom, and I think what we're seeing now is so many moving pieces here. We're watching the Republicans feeling the searing heat on the Iraq War and their little visit to the White House, but they're more and more in formal talks. They are feeling very uncomfortable for their strong support for the administration. It's starting to crack. And these investigations that are taking place, the work that the media is doing, and the American public's attitude is making a big difference as well. I think between now and the end of the year, people will be stunned at where all this leads, and I don't want to do anything that disrupts it.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you. We were just speaking with an attorney with the Brennan Center who is focusing their efforts, an organization that's focusing their efforts on habeas corpus. Our habeas corpus rights, which date back to 1215, the Magna Carta, were stripped out of stripped away from citizens of the United States in violation of Section 9 of Article 1 of the Constitution by the John Warner Defense Authorization Bill of 2007. They're not put back into the 2008 Defense Authorization Bill. I understand that the Democratic Caucus is talking about putting forward a standalone bill to restore habeas corpus rights here in the United States and wherever we may have, you know, jurisdiction of a territory. What do you know about that? What's your position on that?
Well, I support it. I have been just appalled at the chipping away at fundamental freedoms of American citizens. The notion that we are also going to put enemy combatants in some sort of legal limbo, undercutting our moral authority, has always struck me as being repugnant. I am confident that we're either going to have amendments that will restore it when it allow that vote when it comes to the floor, or standalone legislation. And part of what's going on, frankly, is that there is just so much activity and that these people have done so much damage over the last 6 to 12 years, depending on what the subject is. You know, I'm calling you right now from the floor of the House because I have to vote in about 2 minutes. I'm looking right out of this phone booth, and Henry Waxman is right across the aisle from me in a phone booth taking furious notes. Henry and I have talked about this. There's so much that he's trying to keep track of, trying to stay on top of, that it's astounding. So part of the issue here is trying to sequence and do this in a way that we can give appropriate attention to it. I know lots of your listeners and lots of the people that I represent are frustrated because they'd like more to happen, but it's going to take us a while to get all these pieces back in place.
Yeah, but I don't think it's going to take all that much time. I hope not on this one. Yeah,
I
really see the direction with good people like you in the Congress moving in the right direction. Congressman Earl Blumenauer from the 3rd District of Oregon, blumenauer.house.gov. Congressman, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. We'll be right back.
Now we're going to keep on fighting. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Gonzo, Gonzo Gate ongoing. Gonzo, Alberto Gonzalez,
General Gonzalez,
testifying before the United States House of Representatives today, refusing to say whether or not more U.S. attorneys have been fired. He kind of left open that possibility, so it's just, this is getting stranger and stranger. I really agree with the assertion made by David DeGlacius, the U.S. former U.S. attorney for, as I recall, New Mexico area, whatever that district is called, that all roads lead to Roe. And, in fact, the administration is withholding emails about Karl Rove. Murray Wass of the National Journal, he says, the Bush administration has withheld a series of emails from Congress that senior White House and Justice Department officials worked together to conceal the role of Karl Rove in installing Timothy Griffin, a Rove protege, as a U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Arkansas. The withheld records show that D. Kyle Sampson, who was then chief of staff to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, consulted with White House officials in drafting two letters to Congress that appear to have misrepresented, what a nice word, the circumstances of Griffin's appointment as U.S. attorney and of Rove's role in supporting Griffin. So, Gonzo still out there, still twisting in the wind, as it were. Berkeley in Sacramento, California on the line. Hey, Berkeley, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I was the one who called you in December and suggested you introduce Al Gore as the once and future president when he was in Portland.
And I did.
I know.
And he was not happy. But thank you, Berkeley.
Hey, your description of the Republicans as political mafia is so true. So to borrow from The Sopranos, let's start calling the Republicans the Republicanos.
Oh, man. Well, see, the problem is that people probably wouldn't get the mafia via the Italian, via the use of Latin with the O at the end. And, in fact, they may even think that it's a connection to Latino or something like that. But,
it does sound like that. But when they say Democrats, yeah, we should say Republicanos.
Yeah, or we need to give it a little more thought, but it's a good start. It's
okay.
A good start, Berkeley. Thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for that tip, by the way. When Al Gore came here to Portland, he was speaking at the Rose Garden. There's like 5,000 people there, and I introduced him, and then I moderated a Q&A with him afterwards. And I got up, and I talked about how he got more votes than George Bush in Florida. He was the properly elected president of the United States, in my mind and in the mind of many other people. And then I said, I'm pleased to announce the once and future president of the United States, Al Gore. And he came up, and he gave me this look like, what? And said something to the effect of, don't believe I would have said that. Then when he was asked, will you run for president, he sounded quite sincere in saying no. But, hope springs eternal for many of us. I think he'd make a great president. I think, but time will tell. Thomas in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Thomas.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I heard the woman earlier calling about the present bill about to be voted on. And to me, it's just such an obscenity. We went over there and wrecked the oil wells for lies, and now we make up this false claim that we're going to do them a favor by rebuilding the oil wells that we wrecked for lies, and, oh, by the way, then we'll get control of 80% of the oil to do that.
Right.
All we're doing is creating more terrorists.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree, Thomas.
I mean, this isn't going to lie. This isn't going to lie. Even if it goes through, it's just going to create more horror and hell in the future.
Yeah.
What an obscenity. What's going on? It's insane.
Call your member of Congress.
I have called him. I just called Dennis Kucinich's office, and I tried to get information on whether or not he was able to get that in so that would be taken out of the bill, but they weren't allowed to tell me that. So I don't know whether it's in the bill or not. But
the bill hasn't been hammered out. It hasn't come out of committee yet, so they're still working on it. Do you know who your member of Congress is representing you there in Santa Cruz?
It's Sam Farr, and he seems to be fairly good on
so call
a lot
his
of
office.
Issues.
Huh? Because if you call the guy who represents you, that'll have 100 times more impact than you call somebody who doesn't represent you. So call him and call Boxer and call Feinstein and tell him that you're concerned about the fact that the oil companies have their little provision in all of these let's get out of Iraq bills, and you don't think that the Democrats should be supporting that. Thanks for the call, Ron in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, it's a little hard in a short time for me to put a proper context for my comment, but basically, I just have to say that you often debate people who are to the right of you, but I never hear you put people who are to the left of you on. And,
actually, I had a guy from the Communist Party of the United States on here about 3 months
ago. Let me give you more strong context. Let me give you the context then. I missed that one. But when I listen to you and other Air America hosts, I find that you're just too conservative. I never hear a discussion of a general strike. I never hear a discussion of consumer boycotts. I never hear a discussion of a federal income tax strike. And yet we just had a successful general strike in Israel. Before that, we had a successful strike in France. In both cases, the government tried to shove things down people's throats. And by the way, the cases there were far less critical than the kind of things that the Americans face with what Congress and the Bush administration have done. And yet, there is they succeeded. There is no discussion here. It is dismissed.
They succeeded because in those countries, you have a majority of the people. I don't know about Israel, but I can tell you in France, the majority of people who are employed are union members.
But
and they can strike without fear of losing their jobs.
A general strike has nothing to do with being a member of a union. That's the mistake.
I'm not opposed to a general strike, Ron. I think it would be a great thing. I'm entirely in favor of it. I'm advocating for it right now. Okay, let's have a general strike. Now, see where that goes. It's going to get no traction in the media, and you're not going to...